Greetings, Raise Community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Wesley West Stewart, who serves as Senior Associate Vice President of Development at the University of Oregon and is one of the newest residents of Eugene, Oregon. Welcome, Wes.
Thank you, Brent. It is so good to reconnect with you and be with you today.
And just for context, you did start in this role. We're recording this at the end of August in 2024. Mm-hmm. You started with Oregon in June. And when did you get settled into the office you're recording from right now?
So this is like day seven. So you can see I am in an empty office, still unpacking, still in boxes. We relocated from Boston as a full fam about a week ago. So we are just getting settled into beautiful Eugene, Oregon.
Well, I'm not going to grill you for local recommendations on this episode, maybe on a future repeat episode, but congratulations on that. And I look forward to diving into that. But first, I want to know more about who you are and your journey. And so, as I've asked most of my guests, take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that, Wes? What were you into? And what led you to the University of Michigan?
Yeah, so we're going way back. So I'll take you back to a small town in Northern California, where I grew up in Portola Valley. The nearest town was Palo Alto, which, you know, most people know in the affiliation with Stanford University. But, you know, I grew up in a household that sports were a huge part of our family's identity, and really college sports. So my dad and my mom both went to USC, and I would say describe our childhood revolved around USC football. You know, Christmas vacations were, you know, wherever they were, whether it was a Rose Bowl or national championship game. So I just loved that kind of sense of like school spirit and pride of your alma mater. And so as a high school junior, I was also a three sport athlete, so very competitive, you know, swimming, basketball, and then water polo, which may be a little less familiar to my East Coast friends, but I describe it as like wrestling meets basketball in the water. And I was that kid who fouled out of every basketball game. So the club coaches at Stanford were like, you should play water polo. You can foul all you want. And so really fell in love with that sport. And candidly, I had seen that example in my, you know, my dad was a college student athlete. My uncles were college hockey players. So I kind of grew up with that as being an aspirational goal of getting a scholarship and going to an outstanding university that had a great tradition in athletics as well as academics. And so junior year, I actually went on my, you know, my recruiting visit to the Big House, and they were pretty strategic in bringing, you know, a Californian out in like beautiful September fall colors, you know, step foot, you know, in the Big House game day, just fell in love with Ann Arbor. And I would say, you know, the campus experience, right, just the breadth of that place, but also really it was rooted in the two women who hosted me are still dear friends to this day, Caroline and Meg. They hosted me in their Sigma Chi house. And, you know, actually, it's a fun fact. We just celebrated their 40th birthday at Rick's American Cafe, for my Michigan alums who know, the same place we celebrated their 21st. So it's amazing that full circle. But there, you know, I think just my kind of impression of what the team was like and the women that I would be playing with and like the lifelong friends, like all of those things came together and why I ended up at the University of Michigan. I would say much to my dad's demise, he was incredibly disappointed that I didn't follow his footsteps and be a Trojan. And of just my luck, Michigan played USC in the Rose Bowl my freshman year. And so I was that like sole Wolverine fan in my rabid family of Trojans. And unfortunately, Michigan is yet to beat USC in a Rose Bowl that I have been at. So that they still have it over me.
I love the backstory. And also, I just have to say, if there is a moment where people might have stronger awareness of water polo, it should be now, given that the Olympics just ended. And we were watching a lot of the Olympics. I have three boys, they're 10, 8, and 5. And at one point, and what was great this year is I just feel like with all the on-demand and the different capabilities, like you just see more of it, even if it's not live. And at one point I flipped on water polo And I have a dear friend from Northern California who played water polo at Brown. And so I've always had an affinity to the sport. And I flipped it on, and my boys were like, "What is that? That's so awesome." They're like, "How do we learn more?" They love to swim. And literally, it was like you were saying, because they were wrestling. It was like everything I try to teach my kids not to do at the pool is what they were watching in the Olympics.
Exactly. So I do remind my team, if you want to know why, like why and who I am and why I can kind of appear sometimes a little intense, I'm like, just watch water polo and then you'll understand me.
And my understanding is that in addition to your commitment to the water polo team at Michigan, that was an on-ramp to student leadership opportunities. And I know that you were a part of the Student Athlete Advisory Council, which when I was in college was really just starting to, I think, sort of explode nationally and has become such a great platform for engagement and leadership. And my sense is that that might have had something to do with your exposure to the world of advancement before maybe you knew it was called that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, yeah, so obviously getting to Michigan, I think, my student experience was unique. I was actually in the School of Art and Design, the Stamps School of Art and Design, and a student athlete. So kind of had this unique kind of, experience overall of, being embedded in like the School of Fine Arts, but then also having this athletic community. And so, yeah, my junior year, I was elected like the secretary or vice president of the Student Athlete Advisory Council. And I think at that point too is my first exposure to right our athletic administration. How does our athletic department operate? And I think one thing I observed right as a young female was there just weren't a lot of women in leadership roles, right? Like my head coach was a male, my sports information person was a male, our trainer was a male, our AD was a male. And so I kind of was like, where are all the women? Where is our voice when, right, we're 50% of the student athlete population? And so fast forward one of the meetings, Chrissy Rawak, who's the athletic director at Delaware now, came and presented on this inaugural development summer internship program. And it was the first of its kind. The University of Michigan was launching. It was a academic course in philanthropy paired with kind of 4-day extensive internship where you'd be placed in an academic development unit. It was paid. It was over the summer. And it just kind of, just lit a fire in me of like, wow, this could be an avenue for me to have a path in administration and athletics, and give back to something that gave me so much and that just something I just absolutely loved. And so I followed up with Chrissy, and she actually shares a story that I was apparently her first interview, for the internship program. And was placed in the law school and worked under Todd Bailey, who is now Associate VP for campaign planning at Michigan. So kind of a lot of full circle, but just had an incredible experience being part of that cohort and truly was, right, to your point, my jumping off point, and why I am now just such a big believer in these kind of internship programs and really how do you build that connection to your current student body, about who we are, what is advancement, what are the amazing career opportunities that exist in that field.
I love you sharing that, but it also is somewhat frustrating because one of the biggest issues we hear about constantly is talent pipeline, access to talent, creating an on-ramp to the industry. And then what you just described sounds like the most copy and steal everything moment of all time. Like you are literally like, if anybody should have a talent advantage, it would be a group like Advancement, surrounded by, in many cases, tens of thousands of students. And so the question is, what is the bridge that is created? And it sounds like this program was that bridge for you. Are you seeing that like elsewhere that you've worked? Have you noticed impact elsewhere? Because it just does seem like there should be a Wesley or two per year, every single year, just building this homegrown talent pipeline, and it's not happening.
Yeah, very much. And, Michigan actually won a CASE award for the program, and a lot of other Big Ten institutions created similar internships. I know Penn State has a really robust one, Iowa does as well. And it's certainly something I, wanted to be part of building when I got to Boston College. So we launched kind of a similar program called our Next Generation Summer Internship Program, where again, we actively recruited and we looked, we really targeted about like, who are our student leaders, right? What are those student leadership groups where we're going to find students who are actively engaged with the university already, and this could be an awesome opportunity to expose them to this field. The other, piece of it, I think, is like, I am now in a college town, right? We're in Eugene. We don't have, hundreds of other nonprofits to recruit from like I did at Boston, right? Boston was just a field of talent because you're surrounded by so many amazing institutions, hospitals, et cetera. And so that's one of the first things that I've observed here is we've got to capture our current students and figure out a way to bring them in the fold, to train them, and then have opportunities to hire them into. And I think that's something that Boston College, we had a great structure in having sort of a pipeline from that internship program into these development assistant positions where they were really framed as, right, 18-month to 2-year, positions where we're exposing you to, a variety of units across university advancement. You're using that time to figure out, is it frontline work I'm interested in? Is it operations? Is it, kind of the stewardship program events? Is it alumni? And then really being thoughtful and working with talent management to ensure, right, there are opportunities that they're going to have the experience and they can be competitive in pursuing. And I think that's something that's missing in a lot of places is that you have these great internship programs, but then you're not able to hire them right away. And then they go off and they're going to go work at some other university that has that structure.
By the way, before we conclude this chapter, I just have to ask, single greatest water polo memory?
Probably my I would say I think so sophomore end of sophomore year we qualified for the NCAAs, which is a Final Four structure, right? Because we're a relatively newer sport, and we hosted it at Michigan, and so that was really special to have competed to make that team and start and be at our home pool at Canham Natatorium. So that will always be a very memorable kind of end of my season sophomore year.
Love it. Thank you for sharing. So, following college, you pursued a master's degree, right? I think right after, and talk about what inspired you to do that, how you ended up at the University of Washington, and what stood out from that program.
Yeah, so again, graduating in 2008 with an art, fine arts degree wasn't the best time to enter the, kind of the market. And I knew right from this internship program and just my, kind of leadership role on SAC that I wanted to work in college athletics. I think that was what was really distinctive about the University of Washington program. You'll hear a theme. I like to join, inaugural programs and be part of building something. And UW had just launched, again, I was kind of in the first class, this very unique intercollegiate athletic leadership master's program that was really tailored on a sports management degree for people who wanted to stay in kind of the higher education framework. And that I knew about just me wanting to be part of this mission and kind of broader purpose that that was my path. And what I also loved about the structure of the program is that it was like a 4-month, kind of intensive on campus during the summer, and then you had the opportunity to have kind of rotational internships, across the country. And so I had the unique opportunity to work again. This kind of is my theme. I think I could work in any part of the country, any university. Started at Syracuse and worked under Dr. Daryl Gross, who was the AD at the time in the development office, and got kind of my kind of toes wet, kind of getting a sense of right ACC kind of territory. Then rotated down to the University of Virginia and worked actually in their Student Athlete Academic Center, so more on the mentoring side because that was another thing I loved doing was mentorship and kind of coaching. And then came out to USC, right? Had to kind of get back to those family roots, and worked in their athletic department with our that at the time the head of business, which was Steve Lopes, and kind of got more of like the CFO perspective, and then closed out at Northwestern, in the marketing department. So, that was really interesting for me again to work in different conferences, different, urban campuses, rural campuses, private public to really get an understanding of, what's the environment I see myself thriving and where are places that align with my core values. And that's really what led me to my first
By
permanent
the way,
position.
it sounds like you just described it, like you just described some people's careers. That
I
was 1 year. That sounds like an amazing program.
It was amazing, but it was because they were new, it was all me. Just I reached I, they didn't have these internships set up. I simply got online, got on the phone and called every AD, every senior associate AD, and it was essentially the people that responded to me and said, "Oh yeah, we'd love to have you. Come on out." And it was also right. You're in your 20s, you have no other responsibilities. It was really fun to live in different parts of the country and crash on teammates' couches. I think I was in like a laundry room in Chicago with my the women I mentioned that hosted my recruiting trip in Lincoln Park. But I'm like, this was the greatest, 3 months of my life, being in Chicago at 22 and just totally free. So
All right, so
it was definitely a good experience.
you're 22, you've worked at six different universities at this point, and then you ended up settling in to your first sort of full-time capacity at UVA.
And some of that just was, again, I'm a big believer, like you do the work that you've been hired to do really well. And I was that intern that, kept raising my hand to do more. And so they had someone go out on maternity leave. And so Jim Booz, who's the deputy AD there now, called me and said, "Would you ever consider coming back? I can't guarantee anything beyond 3 months, but we need someone to come in and run our tutoring program and serve as an academic advisor to these key sports." And again, I just said, great institution, really respect him as a leader. I love my experience as an intern. And so, packed up and moved across the country to Charlottesville.
Tell me a little bit about this role in marketing and recruiting. It's such a specific description, and we don't need to go too far down the rabbit hole, but recruit for the Masters of Science in Commerce and programs at the University of Virginia's McIntyre School of Commerce. Like, what does that mean?
So I think I learned quickly in this first, my first year and a half of being an academic advisor, and I have so much respect for people that do that work, that it's just a thankless job at many times, right? You're doing a lot of handholding and navigating coaches' demands, and I felt very siloed in my path of being able to have an impact that I think I envisioned I could have. And so I wanted to stay at the university because I really loved Charlottesville and just the community. And so there was an opportunity on the academic side. The McIntyre School of Commerce is essentially their undergraduate business school. And I also missed kind of being creative, right? I had this creative background, and wanted to be a little more, innovative. And so I had the opportunity to come on board, help them, develop all their collateral and their marketing materials for this new 1 year master's program in business, essentially for students who didn't have a business background. So it was really built for liberal arts students who needed that business kind of complement. And I went around the country recruiting students for this program, which in many ways was right the transferable skills that I needed to make that pivot into frontline fundraising again, because I had that skill set of, meeting with students, presenting on the values of coming to the University of Virginia, how this degree is going to position you for a career, et cetera. And that really, kind of opened my eyes too to being part of an academic right setting. I had been on this like athletic kind of track, and gave me some exposure to working in an academic unit as well.
Well, here's what's interesting about like what you just shared is unique to me because I feel like one of the big disconnects around enrollment relative to advancement is that enrollment tends to be more marketing oriented, where advancement revenue is really driven via what I would say is sales. It's sort of the one relationship building leading to material gifts that drives philanthropy. And there's so many times that I've had exposure to the enrollment side where I'm actually shocked that there aren't more roles like the one you just described, where it's like one-to-one sales of a program or an academic opportunity versus like marketing, 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 like, a journey, a campaign, a But you know, maybe there's some personalization, but it just feels like, I don't know, there should be more one-to-one relationship building around huge life choices with material price tags, like, should I go do a master's program?
Yeah, and I think right, it's sort of the same philosophy that right, people give to people they trust, and I think the same light, you know, the people, these prospective students, they want to talk to someone, they want to hear about what their experience could be like, and they want to have a conversation, right? They want to feel like it's a partnership, and it's not, you know, I'm not just getting spam
Right.
marketing materials about XYZ, and they want to understand what is distinctive, what makes our program unique, in this landscape, and similarly with philanthropy, right? There's so many wonderful organizations, but what makes you stand out? Why give to U of O versus another great public state institution? You know,
Sure,
and
you
that's
already.
part of our messaging that we have to own.
Yeah, I mean, you already mentioned your own student recruitment experience, and I do feel like the student athlete lane is one area where you have a real mix of marketing and sales, right? The recruiting trip, the host experience. I was smiling when you were talking about your hosts who are now, you know, still your friends and birthday parties together, because I see the guys who hosted me. I showed up on my recruiting trip at Brown with like the world's heaviest leather jacket, Letterman's jacket, with like, in Iowa where I grew up, it was like my mom sewed on every medal of anything I'd ever done. It's like this thing just clanked. It was basically like they'd call it like a rucksack today, where you like wear a weighted, you know, vest to exercise. Like that was just my Letterman's jacket. And every time I see these guys 20 plus years later, they're like, you know, any
We don't
name.
let it down, I'm
Yeah,
sure.
exactly. So then you had the opportunity for what I just feel like must have been a match made in heaven, joining University of Michigan Athletics as director of development for the Western States. Like, come on.
It was a dream job. And in many ways, and this is kind of again back to right, the importance of mentorship and relationships. At the time, right, as I shared, right, Chrissy Rawak started that development summer internship program. She was named senior associate athletic director for development, and she had to build out a team. She had to build out a regional program. You know, at the time, she was trying to align with you know, Michigan development and bring more integration with the athletic team and the university advancement team, who was led by Jerry May, who legend in our business, who also I, you know, got to know a little bit when I did the internship program. So it was like too good to be true. You know, it was you get to work California and Washington and Arizona and you know, basically my home states, a place that I was really familiar with. But I think what also was really, you know, I think I was very fortunate is that she had confidence in my ability to learn, right, major giving, right? I didn't have that kind of traditional, like, come in as an annual giving officer and learn how to close, you know, gifts at the, you know, 5, 10, 25K level. It was like, I trust you to represent your alma mater. You're a product of what we're asking people to invest in, and go work this massive territory. And so anyways, it was an incredible time to join the university, to go back to my alma mater. And then I will also say, you know, I was fortunate to have an incredible direct boss, which Katie Frohman, who's now the SVP at DePaul, who again, you know, fortunate to work for a female, right, who at the time had three boys. So as someone who aspired to be, you know, a mom in this business, it was also really nice to have that role model, and coach as I was navigating kind of my first, development job.
So they throw you into the deep end of the pool, and as
Exactly.
you said, very familiar waters. And just tell me about, I mean, it must have been amazing. You know, first of all, I want to donate to Michigan Athletics, and we're only 20 minutes into the conversation. So was it just really easy? Did you have like crazy objections you had to deal with? Like, were there any really memorable, I don't know, donor experiences that you think of? Because you know, having the opportunity to like dive right in and like clearly, yeah, you're a product of it, you can speak to it authentically. But it's still like at that stage in your career, asking somebody for $1 million is that's a lot.
And it was a unique time for the athletic department. So we had taken a shift and went into a, I would say, a more corporate approach, right? We had hired Dave Brandon as the athletic director, who was the former CEO of Domino's Pizza. This was a drastic kind of movement away from kind of that traditional athletic administrator who kind of came up through the ranks. And he, you know, had a vision, right, to really professionalize and in some ways commercialize Michigan athletics. But he was, you know, he had some brilliant plans around like the ambition we would have as a fundraising operation, right? He was very sales oriented, very externally oriented. And so I think that positioned us as a fundraising team very well because, you know, there was a clear direction we were moving. And a lot of it was rooted in like the physical landscape. So we had a, you know, $200 million goal around this, you know, brand new South Campus athletic, you know, complex that would really impact our Olympic sports. But I would say during this era, we were also in the midst of kind of a football coaching transition period, right? And, you know, as anyone who's worked at a, you know, major Big Ten or, you know, regardless conference, but, you know, a school where football is a huge part of our identity, the team did not have the most success during my era fundraising. And so there was definitely some tension around, you know, leadership, and where we were going. And is Dave the right leader at this moment, which again impacts your ability to secure really aspirational gifts if there is that conflict with the person leading the charge. So, you know, I think my experience was also really
Sorry.
enlightening. Oh, go ahead.
Well, your point being, people want to back a winner, right? They want to invest behind momentum. And it's a little tricky because that's also part of why we need the support. You know, I mean, you can sort of modify or try to redirect the conversation, but your point is when things are good, it's easier to get a visit. You know, it's easier to conduct the visit. There's just a better tone or sentiment, and you could feel that.
Yeah, but I think it also gave us an opportunity to really focus on philanthropy and get out of, right, this sort of transactional mindset, which, right, most athletic departments at that time were really still sort of set in there. You know, we need donors to give because they want access to tickets, to parking, to et cetera. And it gave us an opportunity to really shift the conversation around, right? You want to be part of this mission of educating amazing student athletes who are going to go out and serve the world and have an impact. And less about your giving because you want to see us win a national championship, right? This is, and so I will say that was a big, you know, that I learned a lot around, right? How to really, I think, elevate people's sights, particularly because I had the West Coast region. People were not, did not care about parking. They didn't care about tickets. They really wanted to be involved and build that bridge back to Ann Arbor in a meaningful way. So I think some of the lessons learned, I would say early on, was just prioritization, right? I was seeing everyone and anyone. And I think after about 18 months, 2 years in the role, it's like, okay, there are certain markets, there are certain people I really need to hone in on. And even if I, you know, really hit it off with, you know, alum and we have a lot, you know, a lot of connectivity, but they really don't have an inclination, they don't have the capacity, I gotta, you know, I gotta move on. And so that kind of, you know, cadence of learning, right? How to, you know, really manage your portfolio effectively and, you know, think about, you know, what are those key touch points and where do I, you know, need to invest my time in people. That kind of came out of that kind of experience of being thrown into the deep end and not really knowing how to do the work in a, you know, maximizing, you know, the
Well,
portfolio at hand, right?
it sounds like part of what you're describing is the importance of disqualifying people. It doesn't mean that they're not great supporters or great people or, you know, friendly, but the sort of ruthless prioritization angle would be it's just not worth your time. Like, your time is so valuable as a development officer because you have seen what 1 hour of quality engagement with a qualified prospect who's really interested can become. And it's sort of like every hour not spent doing that is a real missed opportunity. And it's got to be hard, especially if people, you know, genuinely like you or you connect. So tell me more about how you balance not wanting to, yeah, how do you like assertively qualify or disqualify while making sure that you're not I don't know, jumping to conclusions or becoming even too transactional in your own approach, because sometimes qualification is a journey.
Absolutely. And I think that's also something that we as an industry have to, you know, continue to evolve in, is sort of thinking about, right, the trajectory of people. And I think that some places do that better than others, where, you know, there may be some people that, right, in that initial conversation aren't totally, you know, aren't ready to make a significant investment, but they're on a trajectory, they care about the institution, they have, you know, and that's where our role is, you know. And I think I kind of came up with somewhat of a system to say, okay, people that, you know, clearly don't want anything to do with us, that's a different category. But people who, you know, they want to stay involved, you know, is it, you know, I flag that I have two to three, you know, two touch points a year. It may be simply a phone call, or I'm sending, you know, an article on things happening in Michigan athletics. But I don't lose track of them, but I'm not going to put the same energy and focus. So that was part of my process of thinking thoughtfully about, right, who is going to be with us 10 years from now and may be in a position to make a significant gift versus only focusing on those folks who are in that position now. And I think, right, we're in, we know this in our country, we're in a moment of a significant transfer of wealth to, you know, the millennial generation. And, you know, the way that we think about it, you can't neglect your 2000s. And I see that happening a lot, where you come in and we're just so focused on our 80s and 90s grads. And that's the cohort that's going to carry us over the next 5 to 10 years. And we've got to change how we're engaging with that population and bringing them into the fold sooner.
Yeah, no, I feel like there's such a, it's very binary right now. It's like you're an active prospect in discussion, or you're just over there in the mass marketing pile. And, you know, we've tried doing a lot of work to think about like more sort of sliding scales of personalization, because we can't take our eye off the top of the pyramid at all. It's obviously where the work needed to be done this year is going to happen in the most part. But I even think about it myself. Like I graduated in 2004. Like, I hope I can be a big donor. I want to be a big donor. Like, that would be amazing. So how should I be engaged today? Like, how do they effectively use their time today efficiently? Because there are other people today that are further along and ready to do more than I could right now. But that doesn't mean that I just want emails, you know, mass email. And so it's an interesting, for sure, opportunity. You know, how do we nurture people that definitely want to be involved, but maybe not at the level that meets your specific threshold right now? So sounds like a really formational experience at Michigan, you know, working in development. And then tell me about what led you to Austin, which, by the way, to UT Austin, which is where we met, in fact, 7 years ago next month, based on my research. And I remember, because we have a tradition at Evertrue where we only go to Texas in August and September. We go to Buffalo in January and February. Like, we are the worst at aligning our travel with the climate. But I remember how ridiculously hot it was when we first met.
Oh, yes. The Texas winters, as we refer to them. But, you know, I think at my, you know, I had been at Michigan for about 5 years. I was ambitious, right? I wanted to eventually run my own development shop in athletics and potentially be an athletic director. So the opportunity to serve as the assistant athletic director and lead the major giving program there, in a moment, again, where they were kind of, I would say, 5 years behind Michigan as far as building out a true kind of philanthropic structure where it wasn't just rooted in transactional support. So that was really compelling. I really liked Amy Follin, was the head of the Longhorn Foundation at the time, and just, you know, liked her, right? She seemed like she's got great values, great energy. She's still a mentor today, 80 at Central Michigan now. So brought me in. And again, I think what really drew me in, Austin is this like awesome dynamic city. Texas athletics, right? It's the biggest athletic department in the country. Like you can't, you can't go from Michigan to probably anything else. And so, but also really the opportunity to build something, right? I came in not managing anyone and had to, recruit, eventually about six fundraisers. So really, being able to build it, think about, how we're onboarding these people, how are we equipping them to be successful? How do we integrate into the university development? When I got there, we didn't talk. We had our own database, the university, VIP development. They didn't have, they didn't, we didn't interact. We didn't play nice in the sandbox. So there was a lot of opportunity to build partnership across campus and collaboration and just change our culture while being really ambitious, with our fundraising. And certainly I would be remiss if I didn't also mention I met my husband in Austin and got married in Austin. So there was a lot of really positive life experiences alongside, I think, really growing in my first, right, first management role.
Yeah. I just have to ask because it's come up so much recently. And I feel like we talked about it when we first met 7 years ago, but it just feels like there is such a massive disconnect as it relates to the intersection of athletics data, development data, and the potential to more strategically mine those data sets and really equip fundraisers. Like it just seems like there's this constant, even just last week, I was talking to a peer institution and they're like, yeah, we have a XYZ football game upcoming. We just got the list from Paciolan of the new season ticket holders. Somebody's going to try to wrangle that into our database and then somebody's going to try to make sense of it. And I'm like, it's 2024. This is so relevant. And it feels like it's 1994, as it relates to this part of the advancement tech stack, if you will. And you've talked a lot about trying to turn more of a transactional ticket suite, et cetera, oriented approach into a more holistic philanthropic one. But I would think that like those data constraints, like, and I don't know the specifics of each of the institutions you've been at, but just what is your overall observation on that opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit rooted in this sort of fear of a zero-sum game, right? That if we share information that somehow we're going to lose, support from one particular area. And so again, it's getting to that place to really understand, right? Our donors don't see us as separate entities, right? Our donors see us as one institution. So for us to, I believe, maximize someone's philanthropy and really inspire the largest impact, you have to be coordinated. You have to come as a united front. And so there's work to be done in that space. And I think, looking ahead of, my next stop on the journey, I think Boston College is uniquely positioned because it is entirely centralized. So it's not necessarily the model that everyone can learn from. But that was probably the only place I've worked where they really do work together. And you really see that where, someone, and we have to assume, right, there are not, most of our donors care about multiple things across campus, right? Very rarely are you going to have, an athletics only donor. And so it, to me, it's just we're leaving money on the table if we don't figure this out. And that's really what should be driving all of us to be thinking about how do we integrate this and so that we are aligned, we sharing information. It's transparency is so key for us to do this work effectively.
Well, tell me about the Behavioral Health Center GIF that you worked on, because that to me bridged a lot of different, gaps that are rarely bridged from what I can tell.
Yeah, and this was a really fun one to work on. And there were a lot of people that were involved in the process. And again, like I think that's the beauty of our work. Like we come into relationships, and some, and you're kind of a steward of whoever was carrying that relationship before. And these two were, really loyal women's basketball season ticket holders. And I was liaison to the women's basketball program at the time. And so got to know them, doing, team trips to Tennessee and Knoxville and all over the place. And they had established a scholarship for a student athlete on the women's basketball team. And that year that I entered the relationship, that student had to withdraw because of mental health challenges. And that really opened their eyes to say, we're at the University of Texas and we don't have the resources or plan in place to ensure that this young woman has the support to thrive and stay at this institution. And so that kind of began, took us down this journey of, okay, we have this outstanding, Hicks School of Social Work. We have the, world-class athletic department. We just launched a brand new medical school, the Dell Medical School. How can we kind of come together, bring these partners and figure out a model that could serve, behavioral health needs. And right, and at the time, right, this is not a unique issue to the University of Texas. This is an issue across the country. And through, I would say, 18 months of negotiating with the different, faculty leads and our athletic director and our head of athletic training and mental health, we kind of came together with a beautiful proposal. And because at the time they had this great relationship with Karen Aston, who was the head women's basketball coach, it was also like, facilitating, right? Who's the appropriate person to deliver this opportunity? And it was something that, again, just really aligned with their passion, but also their interest in trying to solve for something that was clearly missing and impacted the ability of, students to stay and thrive at the University of Texas. So again, great example, right, of how we can do really significant philanthropy when we bring different entities together at the table, because that certainly wouldn't have been, the level of gift it was had it just been done in the athletic department.
Oh, it's amazing, and it sounds, somewhat reminiscent. I hosted your new colleague Michael Reza on the podcast a while ago, and he was talking about the Ballmer Institute, which to offer a undergraduate degree in children's behavioral health, and it's such an amazing example at the intersection of like higher ed and big societal problems that are unlikely to be addressed through the private sector solely, and having like such a poignant catalyst where the scholarship recipient that they were supporting like had to go through that as, it's an amazing amazing story. Thank you for sharing. And so as I joked before we started recording, and we're coming up on time, so we'll keep it brief, but I you spent you had a good run at Boston College, and then have now made the move to Oregon. I feel like you've officially like lived everywhere in the country at this point. You've worked in every region, but just tell me about the kind of highlights at BC, and then ultimately what led to this opportunity at Oregon.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I adored my time at Boston College. I think it was really valuable being at a private institution, candidly, just to get that perspective. And one that is so rooted in their mission and their values as a Jesuit institution. And very, and I think of that time, right? We went through COVID, we went through, I had two children, like so much life change, and that community shows up for each other. And part of it is rooted, right? We've had a president for, 2 decades, just such stable leadership, right? Jim Husson was the senior vice president when I worked under there, who's the, VP at Penn now, had been there for 20 years. So I kind of walked into, what I describe as just an outstanding culture. And so really learning, I think, in my first sort of executive leadership role, like what does a really well-run advancement shop look like? What are those best practices around organizational efficiency and culture? And also being there to be part of the planning team to launch a $3 billion campaign, which we did this past fall. And so I can't thank, BC enough for A, the investment they made in me as a professional, but also, right, it was the pivotal moment where I left athletics, right? I made that decision to kind of take myself off of, what I thought I was, on this athletic director track and really see kind of the, I would say, just the comprehensive impact you can have in a university-centered role versus, being in my silo. And so that I am, was, clearly the main kind of, I would say, outcome. And just, again, oh.
Help me understand that fork in the road, because I feel like you must have had you must have so many amazing mentors who could offer you the perspective and like real talk around the AD path, likewise on the advancement path. Like, what tipped you in one direction versus the others? And frankly, what did all of your AD path mentors think when you made that move?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. And I still, you know, I and people, you know, it's interesting, you know, I think there's been, you know, a shift, right? It's a different, you know, with NIL and some of the complexities of athletic, the college athletic landscape, you're seeing more of us, right? I think leave that space. And so, you know, there's a few things, right? I think one, there was an incredible growth opportunity for me to, you know, keep advancing in my career by, you know, at BC. So that was one piece, right? Elevate to an associate vice president, lead a, you know, a much larger team, much larger revenue responsibility. B, I had my first child. So I think too, right, being a parent changes, and you have three boys, like I think it changes your perspective on how you want to spend your weekends and your evenings. And I think the idea, and not that I work less than I did in athletics, I just have more control of my time, right? I'm not bound to, you know, where, you know, we're traveling for an away basketball game at, you know, or I'm, you know, at Conti Forum at 9 p.m. for a Tuesday tip-off against UVA. Like, so that was a piece. And then I think just, you know, from a philanthropic standpoint, like I wanted to work on more interesting, complicated, larger gifts. And I think that's, you know, you get to do that when you can represent the entire university, and the idea of partnering with different academic leaders and the provost, like all of that was really compelling to me, to make the shift. But I also think going back to, you know, what drew me to Oregon, you know, it being at an institution where, you know, I'm not overseeing athletics, that's not part of my portfolio, but I'm at an institution that values athletics, right? It's a huge part of our identity. It's the front porch, you know, in many ways to, right, prospective students, to alumni. And so it's like I get the best of both
Yeah.
worlds, is how I see
Well,
it.
and I guarantee there's somebody sitting there with season tickets that have been a longtime loyal supporter that want to do more philanthropically, and that, you know, you're going to be able to flex some of those muscles and hopefully convert that incredible fan engagement into a more holistic and robust donor pipeline for sure. To that end, are you hiring? What's going on? I mean, do you even know
Oh
yet?
yeah. Yes. Yes. So, you know, I think one of the things, right, we have an incredible foundation, and right, I know you've talked to, you know, other Mike Andreessen and Michael Reza, you have some perspective, right? We have been so fortunate to have incredible support from, you know, very, very top of the pyramid, transformational gifts that really very few institutions can depend on. But where I believe like the huge opportunity is like the big fat middle. And that's my sweet spot, right? I've been a, you know, I am a major gift at my heart and soul. Like that's the work I love doing. And that's the space where we have got to, you know, build out more robustly. And so one of the first priorities in my role and where I see there a gap right now is we don't have a regional generalist team. So we do not have, you know, fundraisers right now at the University of Oregon who can speak, you know, a mile long, an inch deep about the amazing things happening across the campus and really be donor-centric and university-centric. So that, you know, undertaking, you know, I, you know, hopefully, you know, this is August. I'm hoping by December we have kind of a robust, you know, 20-person, you know, development group that is going to, you know, be focused in our key markets. You know, I think the other observation is, right, Oregon is, you know, we're joining the Big Ten. Yeah, we're back. And with that comes the opportunity to, I think, expand not only, right, our athletic programs, but we, you know, we have alumni that we've really not, you know, invested in that are in the East Coast, the Midwest, even, you know, Texas, like markets that we've been very West Coast oriented. And obviously we're never going to neglect our backyard. We're not going to neglect California, but we've got to get in front of more people. We got to qualify. We got to build that pipeline. And that's where the growth, as far as new positions, and where my hiring efforts will be over the next, you know, 3 to 4 months are recruiting those, university fundraisers.
Can I just ask real quick, like, as you think about that in 2024, in a world of more flexible hybrid work, I mean, I know there's still some constraints out there, but yeah, I'm just doing a quick scan. You've got, you know, thousands of alumni in San Francisco, over 10,000 in the Bay Area. You've got 8,000 in Seattle, at least 5,000 in the New York area, 3,000 in LA. Like, are we at a point where you're just embedding somebody in each of those local markets, you know, bringing them to campus, doing the onboarding and training, but keeping them like on the ground in the markets, or are we not there yet?
We're definitely thinking through that. You know, I, you know, again, I've worked in both settings, right? At Michigan, we had that structure where people were integrated in the markets, and I think that was incredibly successful. But there was also an investment from Michigan to ensure that those employees felt connected. They had that, structure in place. BC, we were pretty conservative. Like we had a whole West Coast team, and they all lived in Boston, and they had to do that commute. And it's hard. I did it from Ann Arbor, and it's a tough market to cover. And so we are exploring that. The one advantage that we also have is that we do have a University of Oregon campus in Portland. So we have a fairly robust development group that's based in Portland, which also offers just some, an employment. I talked about it earlier, right? There is a lot more opportunity professionally, right? If you have a trailing spouse, in Portland versus, right, Eugene, we're kind of the one show in town here. And so it's a little limiting. So we are definitely going to have to think more, innovatively about, to your point, can we find some people that we could embed, but ensure that they have that connectivity, that there's an intensive kind of onboarding to make sure that they're successful and they don't feel isolated, being the only team member not on campus.
Yeah. All right. Last point. You've already sort of done this throughout, but the importance of mentorship really stands out through all of these episodes. But I'm approaching our 200th episode, and you're the first person who, in your pre-recording questionnaire, used the word friendtor, which I love. So tell me about your friendtors.
I have a few, and I think because it's in some ways, right? You have a, I don't know how you like, I've come up with a couple people. Like we started, we maybe met at first at NACTA or Women Leaders in College Sports, and you bond when you're in your 20s, and then we've like grown up together in the industry. And so those people, one actually is now my business partner. So, Jamie Haysels, who's a rock star, she's actually my daughter's godmother, but she's someone I call, same thing, Michael Rohrbaugh, who is at USC now. But like we came up together at Texas, like we just, we'll call each other when things, and it's nice to have people outside of your organization that you can just like, what the, what's going on? Is this happening? Like, help me stay sane. And so I think it's important to, right, that you have like they're peers, right? They're people that have like lived it with you. You've kind of, in many ways, I think of them as like my team. It's sort of the same mindset. You were on a team. It's like that cohort is so valuable to me. Obviously, in addition to, right, your more traditional mentors, but I'm all about the friendtors.
Final point, we didn't get into it as much, but tell me about your business and maybe, any general lessons that you'd share, as we conclude.
Yeah. So again, not to go on a total tangent, but as a female coming up in this industry, it's no, there is a sort of, I don't want to say dark side, but right, there are situations in which you're faced with inappropriate behavior, right? We're in these kind of power dynamics, right, where we're being asked to secure, secure gifts, and right, the customer's always right is kind of the mindset in which we were all raised in the industry. And so Jamie and I, our work is really around like how do we empower people in our industry to navigate those situations, to know that you can be your authentic self and you should not have to experience unwanted remarks, unwanted touch, any of that when we're doing this work. And the reality is, right, the majority of our donors are amazing and they treat you with respect, but there are those people. And so we really work with organizations around, safety risk review process, right, to ensure that people, in all aspects of our work, that we feel supported and safe. And so a lot of my work is rooted in, yeah, culture work with organizations. And again, it's about retention, right? We want people to know that where they work, they're supported and they can be you, you can be yourself, and not be, in, fear of, losing your job or, if you speak up, you have that kind of leadership support. So I would just kind of close, and that's really, again, my overall philosophy. It's all about people, right? Your people are your best assets. The work we do is about relationships. And so, that's the group that I, I'm always thinking, it keeps me up at night. Like, how do I make my people feel valued? How do I make sure they have what they need to be successful? How do I make sure that they feel safe and supported in the roles, representing the University of Oregon? And that would be like my final kind of like closing message, right? It's, that we are our most important asset. And so, take care of them.
Wesley, thank you so much for sharing your journey, and I really look forward to continuing to get to know you. Best wishes as you all settle in Eugene. Someday I will ask you for recommendations once you know what they are. And in the meantime, I would encourage everybody to reach out to Wes. She's active on LinkedIn, easy to find. Mention that you heard her on the Raise podcast. And with that, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you, Brett. Truly a pleasure. And I do look forward to staying in touch and, you know, suggest you come out to Eugene in the summer and not during rainy season. So we'll get
Done
you
deal. Consider
situated.
It a plan. And so with that, I'll wrap today's episode with Wes Stewart, who serves as Senior Associate Vice President of Development at the University of Oregon. Thanks and take care, everybody.